You're listening to the Story of Woman podcast with Lindsay Hansen Park. Genesis 3. Now the serpent was more cunning than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. And he said to woman, "Has God indeed said, 'You shall not eat of every tree of the garden?'" And the woman said to the serpent, "We may eat the fruit of the trees of the garden, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God has said, 'You shall not eat it, nor shall you touch it, lest you die.'" Then the serpent said to the woman, "You will not surely die, for God knows that in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." And the Lord God said to the woman, "What is it that you have done?" The woman said, "The serpent deceived me, and I ate." So the Lord God said to the serpent, "Because you have done this, you are cursed more than the cattle, and more than every beast of the field. On your belly you shall go, and you shall eat dust all the days of your life. And I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel." For hundreds of years, the Bible has shaped what most modern humans know about science. For thousands of years, the prevailing theory based on limited views of culture was that women are inherently inferior to men, possibly because of Mother Eve, who wickedly disobeyed God and partook of the forbidden fruit. I grew up with a Mormon background, and this was a prevailing theory amongst us too, that perhaps our lot in life was the way it was because we partook of the fruit. We called it the curse of Eve. Just like Satan the serpent was cursed to slither on his belly, so too were women. But modern science tells us a different story. Just like it tells us that some snakes have hip bones, which shows that they once had four legs like lizards, their close cousins, we know that women as a sex is on a spectrum and falls into a variety of different cultural roles, even through our only very limited view of history. If you were to ask a Victorian scientist who was largely shaped by the cultural worldviews and ideas around him, he would have believed that women's brains were so different that they made women less intelligent. Never mind that women at the time didn't always have equal access to education like their male counterparts. As Dr. Jerry Bergman writes, quote, "The racism of evolution theory has been documented and well and widely publicized. It is less widely known that many evolutionists, including Charles Darwin, also taught that women were biologically inferior to men. Darwin's ideas, including his view of women, have had a major impact on society. In a telling indication of his attitude about women, just before he married his cousin, Emma Wedgwood, Darwin listed the advantages of marrying, which included, quote, "constant companion, friend in old age, who will feel interested in one object, to be beloved and played with, better than a dog, anyhow, home and someone to take care of the house." Darwin reasoned that as a married man, he would be a poor slave, worse than a Negro, but then reminisces that one cannot live solitary life without groggy old ageless age, friendless, and childless staring in one's face. Darwin concludes his discussion on the philosophical note, "There is many a happy slave," and shortly thereafter married. Darwin concluded that adult females of most species resembled the young of both sexes, and from this and the other evidence, reasoned that males are more evolutionary advanced than females. Many anthropologists contemporary to Darwin concluded that women's brains were analogous to those of animals, which had overdeveloped sense organs to the detriment of the brain. Carl Vogt, a University of Geneva natural history professor who accepted many of the conclusions of England's most modern naturalist, Charles Darwin, argued that the child, the female, and the senile white all had the intellect and nature of the grown-up Negro. Many of Darwin's followers accepted this reasoning, including Romanes, who concluded that evolution caused females to become, as Cavalli's postulated, quote, "increasingly less cerebral and more emotional." Romaine shared Darwin's view that females were less highly evolved than males, ideas which he articulated in several books and many articles that influenced a generation of biologists. Romaine apparently saw himself as a guardian of evolution, vested with the responsibility to keep it on the right path. University of Pennsylvania paleontologist Edward Drinker Cope wrote that male animals play a more active pan in the struggle for existence, and that all females, as mothers, had to sacrifice growth for emotional strength. One reason 19th century biologists argued for women's inferiority was because Darwin believed that unchecked female militancy threatened to produce a perturbance of all the races and to divert the orderly process of evolution. Darwin taught that human sex differences were due partly to sexual selection, specifically because men must prove to themselves physically and intellectually superior to other men in the competition for women, whereas women must be superior primarily in sexual attraction. Darwin used examples of cultures that required the men to fight competitors to retain their wives to support his conclusion, because the strongest party always carries off the prize. The result is that a weak man, unless he was a good hunter, is seldom permitted to keep a wife that a stronger man thinks worth his notice. One approach which was seized upon to substantiate the females that were generally inferior to males was to prove that their brain capacity was smaller. Researchers first endeavored to demonstrate empirically that female cranial capacity was smaller, and then that brain capacity was related to intelligence, which was a more difficult task. Among the numerous researchers that used craniology to prove the intellectual inferiority of women was the most eminent of Paul Broca, one of Europe's most prestigious anthropologists, and he was a leader in the development of physical anthropology as a science. In 1859, he founded the prestigious Anthropological Society, and he had a major preoccupation with this society of measuring various human traits, including skulls, to delineate human groups and assess their relative worth. So what they would do is they would measure skulls and they would say, okay, this one's bigger, that means that they're superior, this one's smaller. And of course, they were finding smaller female brains, and naturally that led them to believe that women were inferior. They would have done this to all different races too, to prove that the white race was superior. Broca was especially concerned about proving women's inferiority to men. Quote, of all his companions between comparisons between groups, Broca collected most information on the brains of women versus men. He concluded that the relatively small size of the female brain depends in part upon her physical inferiority and in part upon her intellectual inferiority. So if she was small, that made her weaker. So if her brain was small, it too was weaker. He would explain, quote, this was the result of differing evolutionary pressures upon dominant men and passive women, as if women were just passive in this evolutionary history and it was men conquering the world. These were the views that were prominent in Darwin's day. There are still remnants of the sexism and racism that appear today in modern evolutionary biology. But things have been changing. Great thinkers like Margaret Mead, Noam Chomsky, Betty Friedan, and many others, have challenged all of these notions. Based on the biases of the past, modern scientists are trying to better deconstruct their own biases. Dr. Helen Copinha notes that some biases lie in a division between anthropocentric and ecocentric approaches, while researchers like Kay Miller talk about a male bias. She says, quote, in some of the recent writings focusing on women, the presence of a male bias, both in anthropological tradition and in the society studied by anthropologists, have been treated as axiomatic. This bias has been conceptualized both in terms of male dominance and in terms of male prevalence. The basis of the assumed existence of male bias in anthropology and in society are rarely made clear, but are discernible from the evidence that is consistently put forward to illustrate its existence. There are also plenty of other biases: cultural, language, class, ethnocentrism, culturalism, behavioral, environmental, and many more. Academic anthropologists today have become so advanced in their field of study that they now study themselves. There are anthropologists that study other anthropologists and their methodology and their biases because this has become such a problem. It really sort of exploded in the 1970s when feminist theory started coming out and saying, wait a minute, you're talking about male dominance and how you're saying males are more advanced because they were stronger. How are you measuring strength? Does, upper body strength mean strength? Women have stronger legs, men have stronger forearms as a whole. And these, of course, are generalizations. And when you start to do this with your own biases, you start to get into some really tricky territory. Let's talk about what we do know about the brain. Just like everything else in life, our brain has evolved dramatically over time. Humans are primate, and chimpanzees are our closest relatives. And the brains of earliest humans were similar to those in size of chimpanzees. But over time, human and chimpanzee brains evolved in several different and important ways. Now, this is what we do know, but again, as we're interpreting this data, we like to interpret it with our own worldview. A chimpanzee's temporal cortex is said to have less white matter, so it reflects fewer connections between nerve cells. But humans have far more white matter in the temporal cortex, which shows us that there are more connections between nerve cells and a greater ability to process information. The average weight of an adult chimpanzee brain is about 0.85 pounds, less than a pound. The average weight of a modern human brain is almost 3 pounds. Now, there are benefits to having a larger brain and there are minuses. Of course, when we say benefits and minuses, it's easy to interpret that through a biased look of what we consider a benefit versus what we consider a negative. So when we're talking about this, academic anthropologists try to talk about benefits in a scientific notion. What was best for society? The modern human brain can store decades worth of information that can tell them a lot about predators, prey, area, weather, things like that. It can collect and process the information and then deliver it in an output in split seconds. It's like a computer. This allows humans to look at the weather, say, I know about this weather. I've studied it. I know what it's going to do. And here I'm going to make it's a lightning storm. I'm going to go inside right away because I know lightning can be dangerous. Human brains solve problems and they create abstract ideas and images. And this is important. The thing that sets us apart from most other animals is our idea to tell stories. You know, if you look at your dog is different than you in that your dog doesn't think or give meaning to the future. You have hopes and dreams for the future. Your dog is with the here and now. But you create myths. You create myths about your life. We create culture. We create stories about ourselves, history, and inventions, and all of this based on a myth. We have laws and society, and all of that are myths. And we're going to talk about that a little bit more. But a big brain also has some evolutionary costs. It gobbles up a lot of energy. And we talked about this in the last episode, how you would have to be eating about 9 hours a day to just fuel the energy your brain takes up. Your brain is about 2% of your body's weight, but it uses 20% of your oxygen supply and gets about 20% of your blood flow. Here's the other problem. Large brains mean large heads, making childbirth a lot more difficult and painful for human mothers. This is what we call the obstetrical dilemma, and it refers to two conflicting trends in the evolutionary development of the human pelvis, where when we transition to walking upright, to becoming bipedal, we required a decreased size of the bony birth canal. So we got smaller pelvises, but that became a problem because as human beings were starting to walk upright and their pelvis was getting smaller, their heads were also getting bigger. Obstetrical dilemma has been studied widely because it has increased the difficulty of childbirth for modern day women. Because of this, complications in birth are more frequent as well as the need of assistance in childbirth. Modern humans give birth very differently from their primate counterparts, mostly because of bipedalism. And we've brought Chelsea Strayer, the anthropologist, back on to talk about bipedalism. Bipedalism, walking upright, and the evolution of larger brains have made birth harder on humans. Human infants are almost always born with assistance from other humans because of the way that the pelvis is shaped. Since the pelvis and the opening of the birth canal faces backwards, humans have a really tough time giving birth by themselves because they cannot guide the baby out of the canal themselves. That doesn't mean it doesn't happen, but it's not as easy as other animals. Non-human primates seek seclusion when they give birth because they don't need any help due to the pelvis opening and being a little bit more forward. Another thing that has evolved that makes us different is human babies are born with a very malleable fetal head, which is soft and not fully developed. Because our brains are so big, our skulls have become soft and malleable. This allows our head to develop more after birth, but it does affect a lot of things. you know, other animals give birth to, if you were to compare it to a human baby, about a 3-year-old child. Because babies stay in the womb less so they can make it out of the birth canal, they are helpless little creatures, and it takes about 3 years until they can do things on their own. They have an underdeveloped brain because they have this malleable skull, and they just need a lot of care. Humans, in turn, spend a lot of time and energy caring for their children as they develop, whereas other species mostly stand on their own when they're born. So the faster the infant develops, the higher the reproductive of an output of a female can have. So in humans, the cause of slow development of their infants is that humans reproduce relatively slowly. And this is just one of a handful of theories that talks about that affects the inferiority of women. But we do know now that through scientific data, the female brain is not inferior. Darwin would have absolutely seen it so at the time. He would have seen the woman's pelvis and her slow reproduction as an inferior trait. Because from where Darwin saw it, how he was comparing it, it slowed women down and it gave them disadvantages. Now, if that were true, if women were truly inferior, it's a miracle we survived at all, except we were just there to provide the offspring for males. If we had inferior brains, if we weren't smart, that would be a problem. Now, as a feminist thinker, I like to think about the way that gender affects all of us. It's important that we're always deconstructing gender, gender performance, the way that we perform our gender in society, how it happens. Because we know human sexuality is a spectrum, like we talked about with biologist Crystal Scott, where she talks about that human beings fall all across the biological spectrum of male and female. We do know that scientists now know that sex hormones begin to exert their influence during the development of a human fetus. A recent study by Israeli researchers examined male and female brains and found distinct differences in the developing fetus at just 26 weeks of pregnancy. Now, for those who are trying to deconstruct gender, this might pose a problem. I don't think it has to if we look at everything as a spectrum, but the male and female brain are different just as the male and female bodies are different. However, that is separate from gender, so we need to keep biological sex separate from gender. Gender is a cultural construct. Remember how I talked about myths that set human beings apart? Gender is a myth. It's a way that we interpret biological sex. There's a great new book out called Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind. It's a really fun read by Israeli Yuval Noah Harari. And he talks a lot about myths. In fact, the whole thesis of his book is how humans construct myths. Like gender's a myth, equality is a myth, all these, religion is a myth, all these things that we value, they're myths that are beneficial in the evolutionary, from an evolutionary standpoint. This is a quote that he says, quote, "Culture tends to argue that it forbids only that which is unnatural. But from a biological perspective, nothing is unnatural. Whatever is possible is by definition also natural. A truly unnatural behavior, one that goes against the laws of nature, simply cannot exist. So it would need no prohibition," end quote. So what he was saying is, we always like to talk in modern society of what is natural. You know, there's a big marriage debate, and we talk about the natural family is something that's used, or this is against nature. And what Harari argues is, if it's possible, it's natural, because biology allows it. And if it's not natural, then it's not going to be allowed. What he says in his book is, what biology allows, culture forbids. So if we look at things that way, that's our biases creeping in. We want to say this is what's natural, this is what's not natural. And when we do that, we interpret this data wrong. So we do know that male and female brains are biologically different as a general whole. Now, of course, there are those that fall in the spectrum. But gender is a myth, right? So the way that we perform these differences is our myths constructed. They're not necessarily biological. We do know in these recent studies that several adult brain areas are actually opposite to what Darwin thought. Dr. Martha Bridge Denkla, who is a research scientist at the Kennedy Krieger Institute, says, quote, "Females seem to have a language functioning in both sides of the brain. In female brains, there are areas that are actually stronger than males. Consider these recent findings. Researchers use brain imaging technology that captures blood flow to the working parts of the brain, and they analyze how men and women process language. All subjects listened to a novel, and when men listened, only the left hemisphere of their brains were activated. The brain of women subjects, however, showed activity on both the left and right side of the hemispheres. Now, this data is currently being interpreted as both hemispheres of the brain having this, you know, these both sides of your brain light up result in strong language skills that are typically displayed by females. If there's more area dedicated to a set of skills, it follows that the skills will be more refined. So this could be a factor of a lot of things. If women are assigned certain tasks and men are assigned certain tasks, different areas of their brain are going to strengthen. As a whole, the study found that girls outperform boys in the use of language and fine motor skills until puberty. Boys also fall prey to more learning disabilities more frequently than girls do. Scientists are still figuring this out, but this doesn't mean, I think we need to be careful in saying, this means women are smarter than men, and men are dumber than women or have a harder time learning. That is not what this means. This just means that we're trying to unpack and untangle where our culture and biology meet up. And we're going to learn more and more and more as science comes out. Even before, you know, these studies came out saying that Darwin was maybe wrong in his ideas of the brain and brain size and all of that, there were anthropologists in the field that argued that female inferiority was relative and a bias. Consider Margaret Mead. She was a controversial American cultural anthropologist who changed the game in what we think and know about women. Women are inferior? In 1936, Margaret Mead published something called Sex and Temperament in Three Primitive Societies. This became a major cornerstone in the feminist movement, since it claimed that females are dominant in the Cambri Lake region of the Sepik Basin of Papua New Guinea. And she argued that these women were dominant and it didn't cause any problems. The lack of male dominance may have been the result of the Australian administration's outlawing of warfare. And according to contemporary research, males were thought to be dominant throughout Melanesia, although some believe that female witches had special powers. But others argue that there is still much cultural variation throughout Melanesia, and especially the large island of New Guinea. Now, Margaret Mead, when she came out with some of these studies, people said that this was wrong and she was interpreting the data wrong. But what she said was that actually researchers were ignoring the political influence among women in the groups, that they were interpreting what they were seeing through a Western lens of superiority and supremacy, and thinking that some behaviors meant the same things that it meant in their Western culture. Mead stated that the Arapesh people, also in this epoch, were pacifists. And she talked about this sort of matriarchy. Now, we don't know very many matriarchies, but again, this could be to the biases of the researchers, where how they view things are considered dominance and strengths. Among the Apesh, both men and women were peaceful in temperament, and neither men or women made war. And she theorized that this was because they were led more by women. Now, you have to remember, in the early 20s, there was a whole lot of debate about race and intelligence that was coming out from this, you know, Victorian age of racism and sexism. Mead felt that the methodologies involved in experimental psychology supporting arguments of racial superiority and intelligence was substantially flawed. She wrote something called The Methodology of Racial Testing, Its Significance for Sociology, and she proposed that there were three unique problems when testing for racial differences in intelligence. First, there are issues with the ability to validly equate one's test score with its intelligence, with what Mead refers to as racial admixture, or how African-American or Indian blood of an individual possesses. She found lots of problems with this, but a lot of it, this research coming out, has affected the racism in our culture today. In fact, I have done a large study amongst Mormon fundamentalists who have a racist doctrine that excludes people of African descent into their communities. And they base this largely on research that says the white race is superior based on this faulty science. This is the danger of allowing our biases to creep in and not being able to aptly distinguish between culture and biology and what it means. The biology will tell us one thing, and we interpret it in a way that's not always accurate. And as we see with Darwin and the brain, those studies change. Now, there's so much that we're still learning, and we're going to bring Chelsea to come on, but humans and our origins are just a field of study that have begun to explode in the last century. This is so exciting that we have so much to learn. You know, physically, the human body seems to have changed very little in the last 50,000 years, although our culture has changed immensely. Culture has changed, and its ability to change has changed. Now, we talk about, in modern history, we're going to talk about this a lot more, that the inventions of humans, the ability to use myths, to use tools, set us aside from everyone else, all the other animals, because it allows us more time and more energy to be expended in other places. Now, bipedalism is a huge part of that. So let's let Chelsea Shields bring us in about that. Hi, Chelsea. Thanks so much for coming onto the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so in our last few episodes, we've been working up how single-cell organisms turn to multicell and how multicells have grown and grown and grown and evolved through millions and millions of years to more complex organisms, how they've crawled out of the water, they started gaining limbs, front-forwarding faces, things like that. And we worked all the way up to hominemine, but now we need to move into how we got from that to how we got to us, which is a super broad question. So can you tell us about yourself and what your background is with this first?
Absolutely. No problem. So like she said, my name is Chelsea Shields. I was originally a cultural anthropologist in undergrad and master's, which basically means the study of human populations, distribution, specific aspects of culture. I focused on psychology and medical. So I would go around the world mostly in West Africa, and I studied indigenous healing systems. So I would understand their, you know, cosmology. I would understand their ritual practices, their explanatory models. I would record everything and try to find big patterns and make associations. About halfway through that research project, I realized that a lot of the things I was studying are at the intersection of culture and biology, and that I really didn't have the training in biology I needed. So I was saying things like, well, these healing systems work because they bond the society together and they ease social conflict and the symbols allow people to find meaning that's polysemous. And what the healers were telling me is, no, we heal people's bodies. And they were kind of going at it from a biological perspective that my sociocultural anthropology neglected a little bit in the way that I was explaining it. So I went back and I finished all the coursework and comprehensive exams for both the cultural anthropology side and the biological anthropology side. So in a couple months here, I'm hoping to defend a dual dissertation, and we'll end up with two of the degrees. What ends up happening though, as an adjunct professor, is there's always a need for biological anthropology professors. So I've actually taught biological anthropology and physical anthropology, and human evolution classes more than any cultural anthropology classes. So really that's one of my areas of expertise as a professor, even though my specific analysis in evolutionary theory is quite specific. And I'll kind of go over that real quick and then we'll get into our topic. So what I study and what my dissertation is on is it's called the evolution and elicitation of placebo effects in indigenous medicine. So I study why our bodies would have evolved to be susceptible or capable of a placebo effect. And what that means is, why would human bodies have evolved over all of this time to be manipulable by social or cultural pressures, by someone telling you it's a sugar pill, so your body, you know, manipulates your biochemistry in order to create compounds. I mean, that sounds crazy, right? Why would we have had this trait that's so powerful, actually, that it can mimic a Vicodin, right? Why would we have that in our body? And so half my dissertation is going over the evolutionary theory of that, and we'll get into this in the second part of our podcast, where we really talk about some of the evolutionary transitions that have made us who we are today as humans, especially as what I call susceptible humans, susceptible to one another. So I can say something or do something that not only has a psychological effect on you, but can actually physically alter your physiological body systems, your immune system, your endocrine system. I can change your biochemistry. So that's an important thing that I study, and that's where I really focus on the evolutionary aspects. But for the purposes of this first part, I'm really going to go back to anthropology 101 and kind of talk about where we are, when we are, and how we evolve. Yeah, so I'm going to start us at primates just to kind of get us in the right place, and then we'll get into hominids. Okay?
Sounds good.
Cool. So I think everyone knows, you know, primates are just another order of the mammal. That means, you know, we bear live young, we lactate, we have a lot of parental care. And all of those three things increase, and think of it as a scale. All of those three things increase as we see the, you know, the hominid line develop. So as our ancestors develop, we begin to see longer bearing of live young. We see longer juvenility periods. We see greater parental investment. And all of that will have a major effect on how our brains evolve and develop and how we interact as a social group. So just keep that in mind in the back of your head. We see similar types of increased life history with other social animals like elephants and dolphins and whales. So that's an important aspect that we're going to keep hitting on, is what's called life history, and how long a baby takes to develop actually increases brain size and is often caused by great social groups that require really complex brains. And so that increases parental investment, and therefore you have to have all these adaptations that are quite social and quite heavy on picking up on social cues in order for your offspring to survive if they're super dependent. So we'll talk about that a lot as we work through. Other things that are important as we move through our ancestors are we have body hair, we have sweat glands, and we're able to regulate our own temperature. So those are all kind of things we share with mammals that develop and create some interesting stories in our evolutionary history that we will talk about. So we all, when I'm talking about our ancestral primate, we're talking about 40 million years ago. We shared an ancestral, you know, cousin, to primates. And that includes things like lemurs, lorises, tarsiers, monkeys, right? And then the great apes. Okay. And the way that we break that down is that, the taxonomy is basically that you have prosimi, which are lemurs, lorises, and tarsiers, and they're kind of in their own little zone. There's not a lot of them, and that's why there's so many protection clauses and why people always try to protect, like, say, the lemurs of Madagascar, is that as at current state in the world, primates are very underrepresented, and they're only in very few ecologies. And so if those ecologies die out, then we are, you know, losing enormous genetic and, you know, primate life. So that's one of the reasons we're so careful of primate conservation. On the other side of the suborder is Anthropoidea, and that's where we have monkeys, apes, and humans. And we'll see as we develop along the line that, you know, monkeys drop off, and apes and humans, great apes and humans, are related much, much longer. And the great apes include orangutans, gorillas, bonobos, chimpanzees, and humans. So that's what we mean throughout the podcast as we say great apes. So, and like I said again, I have this great map. Maybe I can get it to Lindsay and she could post it. But the areas where we find primates living and in fossils are actually a really small zone right around the equator. Up until humans, we don't see primates being able to exist outside of quite temperate tropic climates. So humans were the first, basically, of all, you know, primates to go outside of these zones and begin to live and exist and thrive. And one of the reasons for that is the development of culture and the ability to live in different conditions. And so we see that that's one of the things throughout our ancestors' lifetime that had the biggest effect on distribution and survival is the ability to live in different types of climates. I don't know how much we want to talk more about primates, but I'll give you some kind of major characteristics of the hominoidea which would include, you know, things like, here's where we get into that branch that I was telling you about of the monkeys, the great apes, and humans. So you have gibbons, orangutans, gorillas, chimpanzee, bonobos, and humans. And that is a generally larger body size. This is where we see no tail, see a shortened trunk. So you have more stability, flexible shoulder joints. That's where we get a lot of suspensory adaptations for, you know, brachiality and tree climbing. We see much more complex social behaviors in Hominoidea. We see larger brain to body ratios. And like we talked about earlier, we see much longer periods of infant dependency. But if we were saying that the primates existed in a relatively small zone, the Hominoidea exist in even smaller zones. So except for humans, all living hominoids are only found in Asia and Africa and in a really small part of Asia and in a really tiny part of Africa. And so all of the world's remaining hominoids only live in these places besides humans. So again, that's why we are so careful about conservation. So one of the places in our phylogeny, we're not talking timelines here. We're not necessarily talking from Australopithecine to hominoid. What we're talking is the difference between what we talked about earlier, the baboon, the gibbon, the gorilla, chimp, etc. We see a big break between the gibbon and baboon and then the gorilla, chimp, and human. And that's all relative to brain size. So we can kind of construct a lot of fossil records show when we began to see the shift in size from different species and when our own, and that's one line of, let's say, a family tree. And then another side of the family tree is, what about our own ancestors? When do we begin to see the brain size? And there's a great story I have from undergraduate years. I was at BYU studying evolution, right? Which people often laugh about. They assume that it wasn't a great program, but evolution as taught in the biology department is quite good. They have enormous specimens. They do a phenomenal job. It's just not really taught outside the biology department. So in my anthropology classes, I didn't get a lot of evolutionary studies. But we had a professor named Dwayne Jeffries, and he lined up all of the skulls from Australopithecines, or actually Ardipus ramidus, all the way up to modern Homo sapiens, and he put them in a line. And this was a class that was very skeptical of evolution. You had a lot of Mormon kids that were taught that it wasn't right. You had a bunch of kids that were like, I don't know about this. And they believed in intelligent design. And Dwayne Jeffries just asked us a simple question. He said, okay, tell me where the missing link is. And we had to look at these specimens and see how the slight, you know, raising of the frontal lobe and the diminishing of the occipital lobe. We saw the small protrusion of the chin. We saw kind of prognathism go back. We saw so many aspects from specimen to specimen slowly change over time. And it was such a good lesson for that class to just kind of realize that, yeah, you may have heard this thing called the missing link, but let's really talk about how slow evolution is, how related we are, and how much time it takes to change. And let's really show how we put together these family trees and these phylogenies. And it was a really clear lesson that I'll never forget. It was really interesting. So basically, we go from, let's get you back to the record. We go from Hominidae over to, and this includes everything that evolved after the human lineage split from the evolutionary lineage that led to chimpanzees. So this is really what my expertise is, which is in hominins. And that's everything Australopithecines up to Neanderthals and modern humans. And that's what we're going to focus on the rest of the lesson. And that's kind of what I do the most of. So I'm excited to teach you about that. So the basic definition of a hominin is a bipedal member of the evolutionary lineage leading up to modern humans. So this is where we begin to kind of go from knuckle walking climbers, right, with shorter legs, longer toes and fingers, flatter feet, to the biped, which we see longer legs, shorter toes, the arched foot. We see a lot of other morphological changes that kind of differentiates the hominin. One of those is we see an upright skull base. And what that, I usually show my students a specimen where you kind of look at the bottom of a skull, and is the hole where the, you know, the spinal cord comes in at the back where the head would be angled, or is it directly center? And if you see that it's directly center, we're talking about a bipedal ape, right? And so you see a straightened vertebrae, you see a specific kind of pelvis, and we'll talk about that in the future as we get into birthing and pelvis size and shape. But for now, you just know that you can tell in just these types of remnants if something was a bipedal ape, and that's where we get into the hominins. So, and you see changes in the foot as well. So one thing that you see on just the shape of the femur, I don't know if this is interesting to anyone, but humans actually have a large junk in their trunks. We kind of need a really big gluteus maximus in order to walk upright. Chimps have a much smaller one. And we also have these things called abductor muscles that kind of keep our body erect while we walk. And so you need really good glutes and thigh muscles in order to keep doing that. And you see changes in the femur actually over time if something's walking upright versus if something's on all fours. We also have what's called a bicondylar angle on our femur. So if you looked, I wish I had some visuals here, but if you look at a great ape, the femur is usually pretty upright, almost at a 90-degree angle. So if you see it, if you compare it, I usually take my students and I show them a bunch of specimens and we hold up a chimp femur and a human femur, and the chimp femur is upright. And if you hold up a human femur, it angles out actually. And one of the reasons for that is we have wider hips. And because of the abductor muscle. And so you kind of have humans kind of approach their femur approaches at an angle that allows the upright walking. We see different types of vertebrae. We see the arched foot. Again, all of these things are for stabilization. We see the straight up and down skull base. And we're going to take a second really quickly now that we've understood some of the morphology that distinguishes hominids. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about bipedalism and why that was such an important evolutionary transition for our ancestors. So one of the problems with bipedalism is that there's so many different theories for why and how it arose, and there isn't one that's necessarily risen above all the others. So there's a lot of speculation that, you know, humans needed to start carrying objects, infant tools, weapons. And there's some speculation, you know, there's some validity to this, because as our brains got bigger, as our pelvises, you know, remained the same, or you could argue got smaller because due to bipedalism, our babies were born a lot earlier than they should have been, and they were more dependent. So human babies actually do not have the ability to cling and hold on to their mothers as newborns, quite the same way that other great apes can. So human babies are absolutely dependent of someone carrying them, whether in a contraption or with their own arms. And so that's one of the arguments, is that we needed to be, people who were bipedal survived and reproduced at higher rates than those not, that weren't able to walk that way. And over time, we see this shift transitioning. That carrying hypothesis is similarly useful for, like, seed, you know, as we see climate shifts away from forests to more woodland areas, that we would need to carry seeds and gather food. We'd need to gather and carry, you know, scavenged carcasses from one area to another. You would never want to eat a carcass in a place where other great predators like lions could eat you. So you need to carry that to a place that's safe. So there's all of these theories around bipedalism that relate to carrying hypotheses, which, you know, are kind of interesting. The one that's really going to affect us as feminist scholars is one called the male provisioning hypothesis. And the argument here is, you know, that males were out hunting, that women were at home, and that they needed to, like, bring back the meat, and because of the male provisioning, they needed to, males who were able to, you know, bring back and carry more, survived and reproduced at higher rates, and so we became more and more bipedal. There's some arguments to this as we move on to the next section, and I just wanted to kind of highlight that here, that I think it's fascinating that, you know, instead of the female body birthing and maternal infant relationships driving evolutionary factors, that it's kind of on the shoulders of the man that made us upright. So I think that's really fascinating. And we see that a lot, actually, in training and in textbooks back in the day, is that so many of the hypotheses were about hunting and provisioning and leading and, you know, hunting hypotheses, when really, if you really get into the nitty gritty, and Sarah Hurdy does a phenomenal job on this in this book called Mother Nature, we begin to see how intimate the relationship between survival is with caretaking and mothering and whether your child survives in that. And we see a lot more adaptations for that rather than kind of the big hunter, big man hypothesis. So I think that's really interesting. Some other, arguments for bipedalism are, you know, thermoregulation. So to cool down, if you're on all fours and you're in the middle of a hot sun and you're no longer living in a forest, your amount of heat is overwhelming. If you're upright, then you really can kind of disperse heat and regulate in a much easier way. This is one of the reasons why we see different body sizes. So Nilotic East African body shape is often tall and thin and very angular. And this is one of the reasons is for thermoregulation versus, let's say, Northeast or Antarctic, let's say, you know, kind of climate. And of course, no people live in Antarctica, but I mean like a northern, one of the poles. So versus, let's say, like the Inuit, who would have much broader chest cavities, shorter limb to core ratios, we would see much, almost like I would argue, you know, shorter and squattier, because that's way better for a cold climate to maintain and thermoregulate. So thermoregulation is a really good argument for bipedalism because it does affect you so much in the places where we were at the time of transitions. Some other arguments are visual surveillance. We needed to be upright to kind of scout around. And we do see modern, you know, apes walking upright when they're scouting or when they're looking. We have, there's a long distance walking hypothesis for bipedalism where for the first time we're seeing, you know, great apes need to walk long distances. And, you know, being bipedal is actually more, energy efficient. And there's some great studies that are done on that today between, chimps on a treadmill, that are pretty interesting to watch and fascinating to see and argue. Probably the weirdest, argument for bipedalism is what's called the aquatic ape hypothesis. And the argument there is our ancestors, you know, lived really close to water sources, and those that were able to stand upright for long periods of time were very useful near water sources, and that we lived for a period of our time in water. And people usually laugh at this argument, and my students really love to hear this. They think it's hilarious until we actually get into some of the arguments, and they get, you know, it's almost like a funny evolutionary, you know, conspiracy theory. So half the class is like, yes, this could have worked. And half the class is like, this is ridiculous. So, it was basically championed by a woman named Elaine Morgan. And she gives a great TED talk that outlines in 17 minutes what the aquatic ape hypothesis is. But basically that we have a lot of aspects of our bodies that don't make sense in our evolutionary history. And we haven't had good arguments for why they exist. So one of them is, we're one of the only species that has our fat attached to our skin. So if everyone that's listening will kind of pinch themselves, they'll realize that when you pinch yourself, you kind of get fat in the skin. Whereas if you take your dog and you kind of pinch their skin, you can pull it out and there's no fat attached to the skin. And that's what happens with chimpanzees. And, you know, a lot of our cousins. And so why would humans have developed fat on top of their skin? There's a couple of arguments, but what we share in common is that most, animals who have once been water-based animals have this kind of fat attached to their skin for buoyancy. And so that's one of the arguments. Another argument is that the types of fish and shellfish and nutrients we would have gotten from a water-based source would have led to expanded brain growth really rapidly. We have a unique dive reflex that you see when someone is, like if a baby's born in water, the kind of swimming dive reflex that we don't really see in a lot of other animals. And we have a control of breathing that we actually do not share with any of our cousins. And this control of breathing is enormously important. There's many reasons why we could have gained that control. But the reason why it's so important is it's arguably the only reason, not the only, but one of the main morphological reasons why we can speak. The control of breathing is one of the most important aspects of why humans can speak. It has to do with our ability to control language. So a lot of chimpanzees can use sign language. They can, if you put a computer in front of them, communicate via pictures. We've actually even seen chimps teach another chimp sign language. So the ability to process mentally language is actually something that is possible with other primates. But what we don't see is the ability to speak. And part of that is the morphology of how the chin and the palate and the tongue are in transition from a human to an ape. But part of it too is that they cannot control their breathing. So, I always ask my students, and I'm going to look dumb right now when I do it on a podcast, but to give me their best impression of like how a chimpanzee would communicate. And most students in the class and everyone at home try this will kind of do something like, and they're kind of close, right? But how much better is this impression of a chimp? Again, embarrassing. But, the reason why the second one was more accurate was because I was making noise on the way in and on the way out. Because if you can't stop your breath, you're making noise on both, in the inhale and on the outhale. And so I want you to practice on your own, kind of making, speaking while you're blowing out and speaking while you're sucking in. And our ability to stop our breath and make noise only while we're exhaling, basically, allows us to use a lot of the consonants and a lot of the words that we use. One thing we're going to talk about in the second half of this podcast is this concept of evolutionary trade-offs. And what that means is we will have these naturally selected adaptations over time that are useful for some humans make for the ability to stop their breathing, is that we actually are one of the only species on the planet that can die of choking because we don't have two completely separate breathing and eating, you know, apparatuses. And so we can actually be eating and have it stop our breath to the point where we die. And that's something fascinating that we have. But that trade-off was less important than the ability to speak and use language and the control of breathing. So that's just an interesting side note on the crazy aquatic ape hypothesis. So the last argument for the aquatic ape hypothesis is something called, you know, is the loss of our hair. And there's a couple arguments for why we see that all of our other primate cousins have enormous body hair across their bodies. And some, every time I talk about this, people always say, well, my uncle has hair on his whole body. So, you know, not all humans have lost all their body hair, but we do see a drastic reduction in body hair. And, you know, some other arguments are made for that from parasitic load all the way to thermal regulation. So aquatic ape isn't the best answer for that. But really, the reason I'm giving you all these theories on bipedalism is to really show you what separates hominins, and that's bipedalism, and that it's a really important transition, even if there's not one perfect argument for why that came to be. But I want to kind of give you, as we're talking, a little history of paleoanthropology. So we used to actually believe that what separated our close relatives or human ancestors from other apes was our brain size, our big brains, our smartness, our intelligence. It was something throughout the history, you know, of early anthropology that we felt very confident in and had a lot of ownership in, that we're the smartest. So it must be our brain. But what we actually see in throughout the history of human evolution is that we see bipedalism advance much earlier than large brains. And even to this day, we see certain apes have larger cranial capacity. So what I try to explain to people is it's not how big it is. It's how the, you know, the neurology is ordered. So we have a different type of makeup when it, in regard to the frontal lobe and neocortex. And I'll talk about that in a minute. So we have a different morphology of the brain and that changes intelligence. But it's important that one of the biggest transitions we made away from our other great ape cousins was actually bipedalism. And that's why people focus on it the most. And it led to a lot of other differences. So the first one, again, was bipedalism. But what happened with that is we begin to see what's called a reduced head to pelvic ratio. And this is really interesting when we get into feminist theory, that once you become a biped, you actually have a much more constricted pelvic opening from which to give birth. And humans have the hardest births of any other species on the planet besides in regard to pelvic brain ratios, besides the spotted hyena. And the reason for that is the spotted hyena actually gives birth through a fake phallus. And that is by far the hardest birth that you can have. But what's interesting about the spotted hyena is that because she exhibits a fake phallus, she's also one of the only female species of mammal that cannot get raped. She has to actually allow herself to get impregnated, and if she does not, she cannot be penetrated. And so she's actually, the female is dominant in that society. And one of the arguments for that is because she cannot be sexually dominated. So that's a very interesting kind of case study right there of the spotted hyena. So if we jump back to humans, there's a lot of unique attributes of the hominin lineage, but we spent so long on bipedalism because if you have this really close brain to pelvic ratio, there's a couple of trade-offs that could happen. The first one is humans are just born, you know, just have smaller brains. That is just something that could have happened. So if enough people died in childbirth, we begin to see the survival and reproduction at higher numbers of people with smaller cranial capacities, right? Or another trade-off that could happen is human babies are born early. So they're born before they're really kind of ready. And I try to explain to my students that in some ways, human birth and human infants are a little bit like marsupials in that when they're first born for the first 3 months, we call it the fourth trimester sometimes, they're really not done cooking. They're not done just gestating. They're really not ready to come out. But we can't keep them in any longer or else the mom and the baby would die. And so human infants are one of the most dependent of any species on the planet. And so that's where we begin to see a lot of adaptations in maternal caregiving and infant adaptations to be cared for. Pay attention to that and realize that that's one of the reasons why bipedalism is so important, is it basically birthed really, really dependent infants. So a couple other things we begin to see that differentiates, let's say, chimpanzees from humans we see in our ancestor is we get a bigger reduction in canines. We see much more complex tool use. We see less sexual dimorphism, which basically means the difference between males and females of the same species. We see much smaller face, so we don't see as prognathic. And what that means is kind of the nose and the mouth sticking out, almost like a snout. We see a reduction in that throughout, like I said earlier, if we lined up all of the you know, the lineage from Ardipithecus ramidus all the way up to modern humans, we begin to see less prognathism as we go across through time. So we see larger brains and we begin to see aspects of language. And so those are kind of the basic features we argue separate humans from chimpanzees. So some comparisons, other things that we have, you know, we have different, you know, behavioral traits. We have different, you know, ecology and life history traits. One thing I want to make before I say just the differences in chimps and humans, and then we move fully on to human evolution, is that we do see some cultural traits that still are shared with chimpanzees. And so the argument would be that we would see some behaviors found in the common ancestors of chimpanzees and humans that we shared. And some of those are not just morphological or physical. Some of those are cultural. So some of the cultural traits we see are actually, you know, expressed learned behaviors that aren't based on genetic or genetics or ecology. Some of those are we see culture. We see tool use, we see warfare, hunting, and we see sharing. And there's some great examples of all of those. So for tool use, some of the best examples are that certain wild chimpanzee or orangutan populations will share a trait that isn't necessarily based on ecology, that is only shared among that one tribe. So we'll, you know, some chimpanzees will kind of dip a leaf in water and then squeeze it to get the juice out. We call it leaf sponge, right? We saw a great example in Japan of the macaques who would take their potatoes and go dip them in salt water so that their potato was salty. And they all passed that trait along. We see certain populations of chimpanzees who have crafted and used spears for hunting. We see warfare parties, a fascinating example. Jane Goodall created a movie and it shows this fascinating example of a war party going out to hunt in a very organized fashion of a chimpanzee tribe. We see a lot of reciprocity and sharing. So a lot of these cultural traits that we used to think were just for humans actually are exhibited by chimpanzees. And so we would argue that those were, would probably, although we can't, you know, locate these in the fossil record, are probably traits we shared with a common ancestor. Some just important aspects, like to recap primate evolution, is, you know, most of primate evolution is confined to the past 65 million years. There's way more extinct species of primate than living ones. We really only have a very, very small, you know, existence of living primates that we can analyze today. The split from chimpanzee and human was roughly about 6 to 7 million years ago. And then where we begin to see modern Homo sapiens developing is about 150,000 years ago. The difference between that from 6 to 7 million years ago to about 150,000 years ago where we begin to see modern Homo sapiens developing.
Now, Chelsea is great, and it's so great to have her back on, and hopefully we'll have her on again in the future. But she talked a lot about this rapid development. Things have changed dramatically, but I want this to be a good basis for where we go from here. So thanks for listening to another episode of Story of Woman podcast. The Story of Woman podcast is produced by Lindsay Henson Park, co-produced by Jake Spurlock of Wired Magazine, Grace Poole, and Adam Gross. We are generously sponsored by Bluehost and Bluehost.com. Bluehost is one of the largest and most trusted web hosting services, powering millions of websites. If you go and get on Bluehost right now, you can get a free domain name. The web art is designed by Geraldine Hassel Poole, with the music provided generously by Lady Murasaki. Check them out at ladymurasaki.bandcamp.com. If you like what you heard today, consider a donation at storywoman.org.